If I can read my notes correctly, we're to have an address by Brother Duncan tonight on Paul's upbringing, and I now invite Brother Duncan to speak to us.
Right. So good evening, and we have to talk this evening about the Apostle Paul's upbringing. You remember how Paul introduces himself in the Galatians letter. He writes of himself as an apostle, not of men, neither by man, but by Jesus Christ and God the Father. And then verse 11, I certify you, brethren, says Paul, that the gospel which was preached of me is not after man, for I neither received it of man, neither was I taught it, but by the revelation of Jesus Christ. And yet, it is very clear that all the events of Paul's upbringing helped to prepare him for that most dramatic call, a call to become an ambassador of the gospel to the Roman world, and his journeys are marked on the map. And what we will find tonight, that there is really no single passage which brings together all aspects of the formative years of Paul's upbringing. It's only by piecing together parts of his speeches recorded in Acts, also drawing on incidental insights in his letters, it's only by doing this that we are able to build up the full story. And these influences we can conveniently group under three main headings. We have the Greek influence, we have the Roman influence, and we have the Jewish or the Hebrew influence. So we start with his Greek background. When Paul seeks leave of the Roman chief captain to address the Jewish mob, Acts chapter 21, he has to correct the captain's mistaken view that he was an Egyptian revolutionary. Verse 39, Paul says, I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city of Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. As a busy port, Tarsus was a key city in the district of Cilicia along the northeastern coast of the Mediterranean. You will see from this map the road network of the empire. You will see how Tarsus was very much the hub of the communications network of roads stretching inland as far as Ephesus in the west. And on both his second and his third missionary journeys, the Apostle Paul travelled through the district of his upbringing. The reason for this is that Tarsus stands on an extensive coastal plain, walled in by the high range of the Taurus Mountains. The Sicilian Gates, as the pass through the barrier of the Taurus Mountains is known, the Sicilian Gates are really vital to understanding the importance of Tarsus. Importance both as a port and as a centre of communications. In fact, this is the one pass giving access into the interior of Asia Minor, and has always been of great strategic importance. Over the years, many major battles have been fought here. For example, when Alexander the Great gained a decisive victory over Darius here. At the inland head of the navigable waters of the River Cnidus, Tarsus dealt with trade passing in and out of Asia Minor. And like any international trading port today, Tarsus had all the signs of a major centre of trade, with sailing ships arriving from every corner of the empire. The smells and the sounds peculiar to a sea community. There would be numerous nationalities with their distinct dialects and customs. And I'm sure we can picture Paul as a boy, moving around the quaysides, being part of the bustling activity of the factories and the warehouses and the loading and unloading of ships. And really, if Paul was to accustom himself to travel, accustom himself to mixing freely in the port with other races, I think we can also say that the Greek city was for the boy a great cultural centre. We say that because Tarsus boasted one of the three principal universities of the Roman world. Its university thought to, by many to excel the learning of the other two universities at Alexandria and Athens. It does seem doubtful, with his strict Jewish background, that Paul actually attended the city's university himself. Yet, this intelligent boy would not fail to pick up something of Greek learning and philosophy. With all these travellers arriving at the port from far inland, even as far as Ephesus. And when later Paul eloquently addressed the Athenian intellectuals, quoting from their poets, we wonder if Paul was bringing to mind matters learnt and observed in his youth. We know that the chief captain had been surprised that Paul could actually speak Greek fluently. Yet clearly Paul at Tarsus was in daily contact with Greek speech, with Greek culture, and with Greek learning. I think it's interesting to find that when the Apostle Paul quotes from the Old Testament in his public speeches, invariably he does so in what to him from his youth were the familiar words of the Greek Septuagint version. But Paul was also the citizen of a much wider community, the community of the Roman Empire, and as such, he enjoyed many of the important privileges of a Roman citizen. Remember when Paul was challenged at Jerusalem, verse 25 on the screen. He challenged the right of the soldiers to scourge a man that is a Roman. Whereas verse 28, he said the chief captain had had to pay a large sum of money to gain his freedom. But Paul states that I was freeborn. That means that from birth he inherited from his father the rights of full Roman citizenship. And when later on trial before Festus, Paul asserts this special privilege as a Roman citizen, he appeals to the highest authority in the empire. I appeal, says Paul, unto Caesar. That Paul's family, although Jewish, enjoyed this honour suggests that they were of good standing within the city community. The status may have been a reward for some special service given to the Romans. For example, when Cilicia became a Roman province 100 years earlier. And we also know that Tarsus was a free city. Unlike Jerusalem, which needed a strong garrison to enforce law and order, Tarsus was privileged to enjoy self-government by magistrates appointed not by Rome, but appointed by the local citizens. What this means is that daily the boy Paul would be made aware of this Roman presence in and around his home city. The tramp of marching legions, harrowing officials carrying dispatches, the tribute money collected from his own people, and the common dictum of the empire, Caesar, the only king. As the chief city of the region, Tarsus boasted its own garrison. It had theatres, it had arenas with all the excitement of chariot races, sporting contests, and so on. So we shouldn't be surprised in his later writings to find just how frequently Paul alludes to Roman custom. He writes about the armour worn by soldiers. He writes about the sports stadium. He describes the Roman triumph parading prisoners through the streets and so on. In fact, Paul comes across very much as what we would call today a townie. Considering how much he travelled through the most beautiful scenery of the Mediterranean lands, it is very noticeable how few allusions, if any, he makes to the countryside and to peasant life. For the imagery used in his writings, he draws from his observations of town life. The Romans then brought to the near Middle Eastern world, they brought iron rule, government, tolerance of ideas not subversive to the emperor. The Romans brought a stable peace, an ordered society, a uniform set of laws and customs throughout the empire. And the Romans established open frontiers, allowing freedom of travel on the excellent roads. What this meant that Paul worked on a very large stage. Here he was, a self-styled Roman citizen with a strong Greek background, and he was able to use all the advantages of the empire to become all things to all men that he might win them to Christ. The timing of the change of name. Remember, his name changed from Saul to Paul. That was really very significant. And the change came at the start of the first missionary journey. In other words, it came at the start of his work of introducing the gospel to the Roman world. What could be more appropriate than that he should be given not the Hebrew name, but the Roman name of Paul? But it is in his original name of Saul that we gather links with his Jewish people. As one writer comments, Paul was born of the pure stock of Benjamin. He could boast of a lineage from an older and far purer ancestry than the Roman patrician. So when Paul gives the Philippian believers reasons why he could, if he wanted to, have confidence in the flesh, why he could talk about the advantages of his birth, Paul doesn't refer to the privilege of being a Roman citizen. He doesn't refer to the influence of his Greek background at Tarsus. Rather, he refers in verse 5 of chapter 3 to him being a member of the tribe of Benjamin. That's where he saw his roots, in the stock of Israel. So the cutting off of his foreskin on the eighth day, according to the law, actually marked his body for life as a Jew. Just as in modern times, it was the sign of circumcision which identified the Jewish victims of the Nazi persecutions. And that name Saul connects with the Benjamite Saul, the first to rule over Israel. And going back still further, Benjamin was the last of Jacob's 12 sons. So it was very appropriate that Saul of Tarsus, self-styled last of the apostles, it was appropriate that he saw himself as one born out of due time. The terms of the blessing of Benjamin by Jacob are really peculiarly apt in foretelling the course of the life of Benjamin's notable descendant. In the morning of his life, or his early life, Saul of Tarsus would, like a wolf, tear the sheep, wreaking havoc in persecuting the fold of Christ's church. But in the maturity of later years, Paul the Apostle would divide the spoil. He would be feeding, he would be exhorting the same flock which in his youth he sought to destroy. But before the dawning of the mourning period of Saul's wolf-like devouring of the prey, before all that, there were the early years spent at home in the strict family circle of a provincial Pharisee. Nowhere does Paul mention, even in passing, his mother. What we do know is that the family consisted of at least four persons. You will recall how it was Paul's sister's son who alerted him to the danger of assassination. And in the last chapter, Romans, six brethren are listed, brethren described as my kinsmen or family blood relatives. Relatives living by this time far away from Tarsus at Rome and Ephesus. That passage quoted from Philippians continues. Paul sees himself as an Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee. Or as Paul stated at his trial before the Sanhedrin, he said, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. This leads us to look at a considerable influence. From earliest years, the boy could not fail to be affected by his father's religious outlook, an outlook which would dominate the household. When Paul became a Pharisee himself, he would almost subconsciously be emulating his father's scrupulous observance of the law. So exceeding zealous of the traditions of his father was Paul to be, that he could claim that concerning the righteousness of the law, he was blameless. As a child, Paul would be fascinated by the swaying movement of his father reciting out aloud from the books of the law. He would listen to his father making long prayers. He would come to learn the meaning of the phylacteries worn, and he would come to respect the devout Pharisee's care to fulfilled to the letter every detail of the written and the oral law. And so as a Pharisee, Paul's father took great care to follow the instruction of the law. Hear, O Israel, these words which I counsel thee this day shall be upon thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently to thy children. There is a saying among the Jews today which probably applied to Paul's education. At 5 years of age, let children be in the scripture. At 10, the Mishnah or the oral law. And at 13, let them be subjects of the law. And so as soon as he was able to read, Paul would learn from his parents at home passages, long passages from the Old Testament. And no doubt even then, he got into the habit of committing these long passages to memory. At the age of 6, Paul would start to attend the schoolroom attached to the local synagogue. Whatever the influences at work outside in that busy port at Tarsus, inside the Pharisee's house and inside the synagogue schoolroom, Paul quickly became saturated with study of the scriptures and with a familiarity with the traditions of his fathers. The rabbis knew these schoolrooms as the vineyard. Like the rarefied atmosphere of a hothouse or greenhouse, inside these intensive learning establishments, the young pupils were cut off from life outside. The sole point of their attendance was to bring forth fruit to the praise of the law, upheld by their teachers. But Paul also learnt at Tarsus the craft of tent making. It was normal for a Jewish boy to learn a trade when he was about 10 to 12 years old. And this was considered the most important requirement of their education, for it ensured security in later life. Summed up in the words of one rabbi, that whosoever does not teach his son a trade is as if he brought him up as a robber. Even today, we can see the wisdom of such thinking. In the East End of London, you will find Jews, former refugees from Europe, brought together as a community, there to practice various trades learnt as children. Very often learnt, for example, in the Jewish ghettos of Europe. And so, in Paul's case, when he lived at Corinth with Aquila and Priscilla, Acts chapter 18 and verse 3, because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. This meant that Paul could be entirely self-sufficient, dependent on no man. For 6 days a week he worked in the trade with his two friends, leaving every Sabbath free to teach in the synagogue. As Paul once reminded the Ephesians, "Yea, ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities and to them that were with me." We don't know if Paul's father, a practicing Pharisee, was also in the tent or some allied cloth trade. Certainly this flat coastal region of Cilicia, where Tarsus was situated, was internationally famous for a certain breed of goat, whose long hair was spun into coarse twine used for tent making, hence the prominence of the local trade, and hence Paul's apprenticeship to it. But this trade had many advantages. For example, as a simple mechanical weaving process, tent making had the advantage that whilst Paul's skilled fingers were engaged in the mechanical process, his mind was left free to think. And I'm sure we can think of Paul in this guide. Almost automatically he was weaving, he was sewing, but his mind was active on other things. So, to summarise, his childhood, restricted world of Tarsus in Cilicia of Asia Minor, his childhood mirrored the much wider world to which Paul the Apostle would later witness. A typical large metropolis, Tarsus was a Greek city under Roman rule, a busy port with a famous university. And here he was brought up by his father, a Pharisee. Here he was given a Jewish education and trade. But as we know, there was one particular aspect of Paul's upbringing which the provincial city of Tarsus just could not cater for fully. That is his education, to be taught according to the perfect manner of the law. And evidently, Paul excelled in the synagogue classroom. And with his sharp mind, Paul's parents saw their son as a potential religious leader in the Jewish world. And so they made the decision to send him away to Jerusalem, the unrivaled center of Jewish scholarship. There, in his own words, Acts chapter 22, verse 3, there to be brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, and there to be made zealous towards God. Now, age 12, somewhere between 12 and 14, Paul makes that journey up to Jerusalem, possibly for the first time in his life. And I'm sure there will be so many associations with his classroom lessons as he now approached the city of David, to which all Jews look with longing in dispersion. And as the teenager moved around the streets, he would soon be made aware that the city of David did not belong to his nation. Rather, Jerusalem was firmly in the control of the Romans. Here is an artist's impression of the temple platform crowded at Passover time. And you can see in the background the fortress of Antonia. And you will see the Roman troops standing guard, alert for signs of trouble. And just think of Paul, away from his family. How would he overcome homesickness? By immersing himself the more in his studies. Paul's relief came from the national heritage of the law and the traditions of his fathers, something which the Romans could not take away from him. The expression brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, that expression suggests that as a youth, during the impressionable years of his early teens, Paul received the bulk of his education from the most prominent and the most respected Pharisee teacher of the day. In support of this, Luke is still able to describe Paul as a young man at the stoning of Stephen. What do we know about Gamaliel? He stood at the head of the school of Hillel, which was a mainstream body of Pharisee opinion, a body which held tradition superior to the written law of Moses. And Gamaliel himself was the grandson of Hillel, the founder of this school of thought. Certainly in the account of Acts, Gamaliel comes across as a liberal, moderate leader, not altogether opposed to the new way of the Christians. His attitude was to wait and see whether the movement prosper. And so when Peter and the other apostles were on trial before the Sanhedrin, Acts chapter 5, verse 14, there stood up one of the council, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a doctor of the law, had in reputation of the people. And Gamaliel's final plea was favorably received by the other council members. Verse 38, his plea, refrain from these men, let them alone. For if this counsel or work be of men, it will come to naught. But if it be of God, ye cannot overthrow it, lest happily ye be found even to fight against God. What reasonable words they were. And such sensible judgment shows that Paul's teacher was not your usual bigoted Pharisee, but he belonged to that, he was of that rare calibre of a Nicodemus or a Joseph of Arimathea, men sufficiently honest and intelligent to admit where they had gone wrong. We don't know if Gamaliel ever accepted the truth. The conversion of his star pupil to preach a risen Christ, that must have had a profound effect on his teacher. And history records that Gamaliel died 18 years before the fall of Jerusalem, about the time of Paul's shipwreck on the way to Rome, a prisoner. So from this renowned scholar, Paul was taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers. He was given the ability for deep study, the ability to quote extensively from the law, the ability to make penetrating observations on disputed points, and above all, coming under the spell of this famous scholar, Paul would try to match Gamaliel's application to understanding the law for himself. And later in Acts chapter 26, verses 4 and 5, Paul tells King Agrippa about my manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem. And they could testify that after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. Or as the Galatian believers had heard from Paul, when he spoke of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion, how I profited it in the Jews' religion above many my equals or age in mine own nation, being more exceeding zealous of the traditions of my fathers. That Paul quickly rose to command attention at a young age in the Pharisaic movement shows that he was an ideal pupil. One writer has written of Paul, perhaps rather harshly, but he says that the prejudices of the Pharisee house surrounded his cradle. His Judaism grew like the mustard tree in the Gospels, and intolerance, fanaticism, national pride and hatred, among other passions, built their nests among its branches. And Jewish writers tell us about the normal conduct of these schools. We quote, "It is the tradition of the synagogue that they sit while they dispute, the elders in dignity on high chairs, those beneath them on low seats, and last of all on mats upon the pavement." The teaching method was based on a public reading of a passage from the Old Testament, mostly the law, which was then openly discussed and interpreted. The pupils were encouraged to refer back to the works of earlier scholars, and there would be endless discussions on allegories, on types, and so on. We're reminded of the boy Jesus among the learned men in the temple, both hearing them and asking them questions. And these debating skills, learned in the school of Gamaliel, I'm sure later helped Paul to express himself lucidly in public, giving him the ability to present complex arguments in a clear and logical way. And when Paul comes to write down such sharply reasoned letters as, say, Romans or Hebrews, granted divine inspiration, but that apart, clearly the writer is fully acquainted with Israel's past, acquainted with Israel's law, with her festivals, and with her customs. We have been considering Paul, the teenage student at Jerusalem. And I think a valid question to ask is, could his stay at Jerusalem have been contemporary with Christ's own ministry and at the time of his crucifixion? Whilst we cannot be in any way certain on this point, perhaps it is significant that nowhere in his public addresses or in his writings does Paul refer to any earlier meeting with Christ before Damascus. I think this fact is important in the light of the Pharisees' known hostility to the Galilean teacher who claimed to be their Messiah. We have noted already that at Stephen's death, the bystander Paul is described as a young man. And most authorities date Paul's birth back from this date to about the year AD 1, 4 or 5 years after Christ's own birth in Judea. So where was Paul during Christ's ministry? If Paul came over to Jerusalem in his early teens to study, then conceivably within, say, 10 years, he completed the instruction to become a fully-fledged Pharisee himself. And it seems quite possible that he then returned to his hometown of Tarsus, there to practice his profession. Therefore, he was out of the way of Jesus. It's interesting that when we next have reference to Paul back at Jerusalem, he was probably in the synagogue of the province of Cilicia. He was among Jews from his hometown of Tarsus. Another very appealing suggestion in the light of his later travels, the suggestion is that on completing his studies, Paul was sent on a proselyting mission to other lands. Such work would suit an intelligent, enthusiastic young Pharisee. For as Jesus said, they compass sea and land to make one proselyte. And I think the following quotation will round off this section of our address. It summarizes very well the thinking of the Pharisee at the time of Roman rule. We quote, "National defense was no longer to fortify Jerusalem against the heathen, but the law could be fortified like an impregnable city. The place of the brave is on the walls and in the front of the battle, and the hopes of the nation rested on those who defended the sacred outworks and made successful inroads on the territories of the Gentiles." So, contemporary with Paul's upbringing was the preaching of Jesus. Peter, and also with the preaching of Peter and the other apostles. But the view of the Jewish leaders, at least at first, was that here was just another division of opinion led by a now dead Nazarene rabbi. Indeed, there were no fewer than 480 synagogues in Jerusalem at the time. So that, I suppose, was a reasonable opinion to hold. But as this new set prospered, as this new set became increasingly bold, the Jewish establishment, of which the Pharisees were very much part, took steps to silence this dangerous threat to their prestige and to their authority. The trouble which led to the stoning of Stephen started in a synagogue whose membership was drawn from five districts of the Jews dispersed abroad, including, very significantly, Acts 6 verse 9, the province of Cilicia. So there were members of this synagogue where the problem with Stephen came to head who came from Cilicia. They came from Tarsus. And knowing Paul's later part in the episode, knowing his prominence as a Pharisee, it's very reasonable to assume that Paul himself led the debate in that synagogue. However, verse 10, they were unable to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which Stephen spake. And I'm sure that first debate sowed the initial doubts in the mind of Saul, doubts which would intensify as he listened to Stephen's mastery summary of Israel's history. And then verse 12 tells how Stephen was roughly taken from the synagogue to appear before the Jewish council of the Sanhedrin. And if, as seems likely, Paul was there himself to listen to Stephen's defense, we can ask, in what capacity was he there? Because opinion seems to be divided as to whether or not Paul was himself a member of the Sanhedrin Council. Some authorities feel that his young age excluded him from being a judicial member, since one requirement was that the candidate be a father of children. Against this, there is Paul's later statement, "I gave my voice against them." I gave my voice, a possible reference to Paul casting his vote with others on the council. And then Acts chapter 8, verse 1, Paul was consenting unto Stephen's death. He took pleasure in this cold-blooded act. What we do know is that by this time the Sanhedrin was no longer empowered by the Romans to apply the death sentence on their own. This means that the uproar of the council, The members forcing Stephen through the streets to be stoned outside the city, all this was highly irregular. And although done out of zeal for the law, it was really an act of murder. But the young Pharisee did not himself cast stones. Those responsible for the crime, they laid their clothes at the feet of Paul, who would have observed the foul deed, and he would have heard Stephen's moving prayer, asking God not to lay this sin to their charge. I wonder how many times Saul the persecutor was to witness similar courage and faith, clear signs of the integrity of the early Christians. And ironically, Paul himself one day would stand before the same Sanhedrin council. And this time, not as possibly a council member, but this time as the accused. Just like Stephen, he would be a Christian. And we feel sure that Stephen's gentle, forgiving example was a very real help to Paul the Christian when he was on trial. Following the stoning of Stephen, Paul's career as a Pharisee reaches a climax with his leading active role in persecuting the church. Almost as if the trial and the murder of Stephen somehow disturbed him. Our next slide groups together four key references back to this turbulent period, and they combine to portray acute terror for the church. So we have him persecuting the church, beyond measure persecuting the church and wasting it, persecuting unto the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. Many of the saints, Paul says, I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. And I punished them oft in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even unto strange cities. We are used to reading about atrocities in Syria and the crimes of Assad, but really the crimes of the persecutors of Saul and others, their crimes were really on the same level. Sorry. The worst methods then of modern police state were used to make victims blaspheme the name of Christ. And yet, despite all this zealous activity, the Pharisee could have no inner peace of mind. In his frenzy of hate, there could be little love for his fellow man, could there, which should have been the very essence of the law. And it needed the blinding light outside Damascus to arrest the Pharisee in his tracks. The voice of Jesus calls him by not his Greek name, his Roman name, it calls him by his Hebrew name, Saul. And just like, and with just six words, the Pharisee is challenged. And after being led blind into the city for 3 days, he waits in darkness. 3 days as the mindset of the Pharisee is transformed into the submissive disciple's cry, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And wonderfully, He became companion, he became a fellow worker with the Christians. He had come to Damascus to torment, and they accepted him as Brother Paul, an equally amazing situation, because they knew why he had come to Damascus. And we want to note the very first thing Paul did after his baptism, that is, and after his stay in Arabia, which we read about in Galatians. We read in Acts chapter 9, verse 20, and straightway, in other words, the first thing, he preached Christ in the synagogues, that he is the Son of God. What incredible courage early on. For Paul could be under no misapprehension that his number one enemies were now the Pharisees. And knowing, as we do, Paul's familiarity with synagogues, his familiarity with Jewish worship, it's very interesting that immediately he makes use of his upbringing to start right here in the synagogue with his preaching work. Wherever Paul now travelled, his starting point was always the local synagogue, the social centre of the dispersed Jewish communities. You see, Paul had this unique advantage over his kinsmen. He knew from inside the workings of their system based on the law and their tradition. As a former Pharisee, he knew the way their minds worked. He knew their arguments inside out, arguments which he himself had used when examining suspected Christians. And also he had the privilege of mixing freely with members of the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem, with the very elite of the Jewish nation. And no doubt he had spoken to older members to learn from them how they had watched Jesus and how they had tried to trap him with trick questions. What an invaluable insight into the mind of the enemy that Paul enjoyed. And this was why Paul, from now on, was so outspoken in condemning the wrong thinking of the Judaizers, those who entered under false pretenses the Church of Christ. Because hadn't he himself made the hard choice to renounce his past? And it is when we take into account Paul's background as a prominent Pharisee that his statements about the law of Moses have a distinct ring of authority, and they carry deep conviction. Take his very first recorded public speech at Antioch in Pisidia. Paul concludes his address to the Jewish audience, "Ye cannot be justified by the law of Moses." What a brave statement to make inside the synagogue. "Ye cannot be justified by the law of Moses." Again, we see the ex-Pharisees' insistence that Gentiles be allowed to be brought into the Christian community. See him withstand Peter to the face. He says, "If thou, being a Jew, livest as do the Gentiles, and not as the Jews, how compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews?" So what an amazing reversal. Philippians chapter 3, verse 7. "Whatsoever things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ." Prestige, career. Paul quite happily suffered the loss of all these things. His sole objective now was to win Christ. And so Paul put off the dress. He put off the mind of the Pharisee. And he put on the preparation of the gospel of peace. It is most likely that after his conversion, Paul's strict Pharisee father had nothing further to do with his wayward son. Indeed, many would say that the whole world turned against him. But that didn't worry Paul. After his baptism at Damascus, what did he gain? He gained forgiveness of sins. He now had a clear conscience over past crimes, and he gained a peace of mind. He would be no longer haunted by past crimes. And Paul never ceased to give thanks for this change, although we are certain that he felt the need for those formative experiences of his early upbringing, both at Tarsus and Jerusalem, to prepare him for the work. And our last reference is from Galatians chapter 1. And it implies that Paul's calling process started right back at the time of his birth into the house of a Pharisee. Verse 15 draws together the various strains of his upbringing, which we've been talking about this evening, all vitally important for creating that new man in Christ, for creating Paul the Apostle. When it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace to reveal his Son in me, that I might preach him among the heathen. And the passage goes on to describe the response of the believers in the churches of Judea to this quite amazing reversal. I'm sure the response was first seen by the Christians in Damascus. And now Paul mentions the response of the churches of Judea. Paul says that they, the churches of Judea, the churches of Christ, they had heard only that he which persecuted us in times past now preacheth the faith which once he destroyed, and they glorified God in me.